And welcome back to Coast, as we, of course, are doing our special Art Bell tribute program. Art passed away at the age of 72, 2 years ago, of a prescription overdose. It was an amazing story. We couldn't believe it when we were getting news of it that night, and we couldn't verify it. We hadn't been able to talk to the sheriff's department yet. I called George Knapp, who lives in Vegas, and I said, George, you need to work on this for us. And he came back to us and confirmed it, and said the sheriff's department had just sent out a news release that he had passed away. It was unbelievable. Up next, Major Ed Dames joins us, the foremost remote viewer, as we talk about the life of Art Bell. And welcome back to our special Art Bell tribute show. George Norrie with you, Major Ed Dames back with us, the world's foremost remote viewing teacher, of course. Ed, thank you for participating in this. Really appreciate it.
What are you doing up so late?
I'm always up late. You know that.
Well, as one grandfather to another, I'd like to first say a happy Easter to you and your family and to all your listeners and Lisa, Tom, Stephanie, and Lex.
Thank you, Ed. Well, do you remember the very first time you were on with Art?
Yeah, I did. And I visited that a couple of years ago when we did the first show. But I wanted to tell you something that's really more cogent and poignant about that. With regard to when he passed away on Friday the 13th.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Yeah, okay. So I have one thing in common with Art, and as kids and adults, we both love radio. I love radio too. I was a shortwave listener from the 10 years old, and I have QSL cards from all over the world, from radio stations that don't exist anymore, and even countries that don't exist. So, I have a shortwave radio on my desk, a very nice one. Unfortunately, I'm always so busy, I don't have time to listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always tuned to KFBK in Sacramento, which is an affiliate of of yours. And so whenever I can, I listen to Coast to Coast. Anyway, 24 hours after Art passed away, something interesting happened. This shortwave of mine has two alarms, like many radios do. And I've never used them. I have no use for an alarm on a radio. But at 22:05, at 10:05 p.m., 1 day after Art passed away, the radio by itself turned on.
Oh, my God.
Bumper stick. And I'm not kidding. Oh. This is a true story. So
it was his way, Ed, to try to communicate with you, my friend. And you were always very special to him. I will always remember that. And you are always very special to this program. Major Ed Dames, thank you, Ed, for popping in. And that was a great story. It really is. Now, of course, remembering Art, of course, who could forget the moments when he talked about the Philadelphia experiment with Al Bielek, a truly remarkable programs that he did several times. Al Bielek is no longer with us either.
Where was the ship positioned when they began the test, Al? It was just in the harbor?
It was in the harbor about 6 miles downstream from the actual Navy Yard. There was a place in the harbor called Tinicum Island, which was about 6 miles down. You can find it on any map of Philadelphia in that area. And that's where they conducted the test.
So they got it away from the dock?
Yes.
They must have been a little unsure of the size of the field that would be created.
Correct.
What and did they have in the way of observers? In other words,
they had, for the first test of the Eldridge, which was July 22nd, 1943, there was one observer ship, and that was a carrier.
One observer ship, and so they had, I'm sure, cameras and radar at that point.
Yes. By that point, radar was well-developed, and that was one of the primary concerns. Will it be not only invisible to the eye and to camera, but will it be invisible to radar?
So you were down in the control room, I assume in radio contact with them?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you describe the procedure you went through to crank this thing up?
Well, there are several pieces of equipment we had to turn on in sequence and bring the power level up on the generators, which was for the magnetic field, rather slowly. And when everything was up to a proper level, then what happened to those who were viewing it from the carrier deck, was you saw this very strange rotating field sort of glistening. It's hard to describe exactly, but you saw this thing rotating, and the next thing you know, the ship fades out, and you don't see anything except a water line.
And I assume on radar as well?
Yes. The radar image weakened and then disappeared.
Wow.
They were happy.
All right, so 12 August comes. Now you've got the Eldridge with how many people aboard?
The same number. It was about 25.
About 25. Most of them on deck?
No. There was only approximately 6 or 8 people, as I remember now. There was about 8 people on deck, and the rest were below deck. Duncan and I were in the control room. Of course, there was a captain on board the ship who took the ship down to its station for the test, and then he removed himself from the bridge and went down below where it was safer. And for the final test, we had 3 observer ships, a carrier with the same personnel on board watching the test, a merchant ship known as the SS Furyasef, and a Coast Guard cutter. So there it was, and all of a sudden there was a blue flash of light. The ship vanished, the water line vanished, and there was nothing but just calm bay water there.
Like that? Just like that?
Just like that.
A blue flash. The water line that was invisible vanished, the ship gone.
Right.
Just flat gone?
That's right. And, of course, they could not raise it on radio. They attempted to do so. The ship was gone about 4 hours. Of course, Van Norman was biting his fingernails, so to speak, and so was everybody else, including Captain Harrison and all the other scientific personnel watching it. They didn't know what to do, so they sat there in the carrier and the other ships, and they waited. It was nearly 4 hours later the ship returned to the same spot where it had apparently left.
Four hours. And it with the same kind of flash and then...
No, there was no flash on its return, just it faded back into view.
God.
And there it was.
All right. Now let's go back to you in the control room. You start throwing the switches, and... What happened to you, Al?
Well, Duncan and I were there. Everything appeared normal at first for about 30 seconds. Then we started to see some strange effects. And then the next thing that happens in the control room, we start to get what appeared to be high voltage arc over, and there was no high voltage equipment in the control room.
Hmm.
Well, with this going on, we turned to the radio, and of course we got nothing but hiss and static. We had no way of knowing at that point that we were no longer sitting in the harbor. But we couldn't get anyone on the radio, so we said, well, this thing is getting worse.
Did you have instructions, by the way, if anything goes wrong?
Absolutely.
Shut this sucker down right away, or what?
Yes, it was up to our discretion to shut it down if we had to.
No communication with anybody up on deck?
No, not at this point. We were in a closed and locked control room.
All right.
So we decided it's time to shut the equipment off, so we went for the main power control handles, which were essentially very large knife switches, and we couldn't budge them, we couldn't move them, we couldn't shut the power off. And this condition kept getting worse, so we decided it's time to get out of this control room. We opened the bulkhead door, ran out on deck.
God.
And nobody was buried in the deck at that point, but everybody was milling around in a very strange manner. And at that point, Duncan and I got the bright idea, well, let's jump overboard. This condition is hopeless.
In other words, abandon ship.
Abandon ship, yeah. We didn't care what anybody else was doing. We decided to abandon ship.
Can you remember when you went up on deck, obviously this field was all around you. What did it look like on deck? You saw the men, they were standing or walking or still alive.
Yes.
And what did the air and the water and the, I mean, can you describe
on
what?
On deck of the ship, it was sort of hazy, a slightly hazy green look. And as I found out later, that color of green is characteristic of ozone or oxygen, particularly ozone.
Uh-huh.
And beyond the railing of the ship, you could see quite clearly on the ship, but beyond the railing of the ship, you could see nothing.
You couldn't?
Solid gray haze.
You couldn't see water?
Couldn't see water. We couldn't see the shoreline. We couldn't see anything.
Without being able to see the water. Now, I understand the conditions you were in at that point were dramatic and horrid.
Yes.
But, boy, what a calculated risk to jump into what seemed to be at that point an abyss.
Mm-hmm. Which is exactly what we did. We never hit the water. And it was, in a certain sense, an abyss. The feeling, however, was much more like falling down an elevator shaft that had no bottom. We never hit anything. We just kept falling in a panic mode, panic feeling. We were within sight of each other.
Yeah, I was going to ask. You could see each other?
Yes.
And you were apparently falling into what, blackness or mist?
Into a strange hazy mist with all kinds of strange whirling lights and this sort of thing.
Oh, my God.
Well, this went on for a period of time. Subjectively, we could only estimate the time as perhaps about 2 minutes, and that's strictly a subjective estimate. And the next thing we know, we're landing and standing on our feet in some kind of a place. It was night. And
a gentle landing? A crash?
It was a gentle landing. And there was a chain-link fence immediately to our back, which we recognize as a military-style fence. Suddenly, we were illuminated from overhead with a blinding searchlight. And then suddenly MPs come out of someplace and grab us and escort us to a building. The doors are open for us. We go in the building, then we're pushed on an elevator along with the MPs. We go down several levels, and the elevator door opens. And we look, and we see military personnel. We see all kinds of strange equipment. And we see one elderly civilian walking towards us.
Elderly civilian?
Yes, with almost no hair on him, white hair.
Mm-hmm.
He introduces himself to me and says, "Gentlemen, I've been waiting for you. I'm Dr. John von Neumann." So we look at him and says, "You're who?"
Right.
Says, "I'm Dr. John von Neumann." I said, "You couldn't be. We just left him about an hour or so ago. He's a much younger man." He looked at us a little bit sternly and in his typical brogue. Said, "Gentlemen, I am the same Dr. von Neumann you knew in 1943. This is 1943. It's 1983, and you're at Montauk, Long Island. Welcome," or something to that effect. Well, we didn't believe him. We thought he was a bit off his rocker, whoever he was. We didn't believe him, but nevertheless, they gave us the Cook's tour of the underground. We saw all kinds of modern electronic equipment, like IBM 360 and 370 computers, which did not exist in 43, the hard disk drives, tape drives, large screen video displays.
Oh, God.
Graphic displays.
Your eyes must have been wide open.
Oh, they were. And after we got done with that tour, they sat us down in front of a TV set, large screen color TV, which of course didn't exist in 1943.
What was that like, seeing that?
That was rather interesting because we watched this, and there were over several hours discussions about man and the moon, the Cold War, views of modern cities with their freeways and their incredible traffic jams. But the thing that really got to us was one of the commercials in which they were saying, "On your next vacation trip to Hawaii, why not fly with us in our 747 jet?" And then they show a picture of a 747 jet. Well, to somebody in this era, that doesn't mean anything. But to somebody from 1943, we look at this and say, "What the hell is that?"
Of course. God, a 747.
So at this point, we said, "Well, maybe the old man is right. Maybe we are in 1983.
Yeah.
Well, daylight, we arrived at about 2 a.m. in the morning, and we didn't know where or when. We were informed that it was the 12th of August, 1983. And at the daylight hours, we did get a small tour of the upstairs above surface base, but not long. We were not allowed off base. And then Dr. von Neumann put it to us. He says, "We got a real problem, gentlemen. I can shut off our equipment here, but we can't control what's going on in the Eldridge." So the Eldridge is in hyperspace. You jumped off of it and arrived here. How, we don't know. But you've got to go back to the Eldridge and shut off the equipment so it can return to its normal location.
Why did he think that you could get back to the Eldridge?
Well, to finish the statement, he said the problem is there is a huge hyperspace bubble which the ship is in, and it's growing. The equipment has to be shut off. And he says, I said to him, he says, "Well, that's just fine. How are we supposed to get back there?" He says, "That's no problem. We can send you there." He says, "Here at Montauk, we have complete control over space and time. We can send you anywhere as we want at any time we want." And they did. They sent us back to the decks of the Eldridge with instructions, destroy the equipment if you have to, but get it shut off. And he said the ship will return to the harbor in 43, but you must destroy the equipment if necessary.
All right, so for some reason, though, it had to be you that went back. So,
right.
So then...
They sent us back to the Eldridge, and we found some axes and with heavy insulated gloves on because...
Okay, can I stop you? Please, let me stop you. You went by that too fast. They sent you back to the Eldridge. Obviously, you had to be able to get a look at some of what they had in 1983, equipment-wise,
yes,
to be able to accomplish that. What did you see?
What did we see?
Yep.
Modern computers, hard disk drives, all kinds of other equipment. We saw, of course, in the other underground sections, very large, heavy electronic equipment, which was totally beyond our comprehension at that point. And, of course, this was part of the operating hardware for Montauk for the time tunnels. They had solved the problems of travel through space and time simultaneously, which we did not understand at that point. And all of that equipment, was levels of it.
Okay, so you got to see...
All over the place. Very,
right.
Very high power.
You got to see a lot of stuff you probably didn't understand at that point.
Right. We did not understand it at that time.
So what did they do? Sit you in a chair? Or
no. We were set up. They turned the equipment on. The tunnel appeared out of nowhere as in a wall. And they said, well, you just walk into that and you'll wind up back in the Eldridge. And we did.
And you did. And so there you were back on the Eldridge. Where did you end up on the Eldridge?
On the deck.
On the deck.
And we then went in the control room, found axes and the smashed equipment until the generator started to wind down. At that point, we knew it was over. So we came back out on deck. And then when we saw two sailors buried in the steel deck, two more in the bulkhead upright, one of them was our younger brother, Jim, who had enlisted in the Navy after Pearl Harbor.
Alive?
They were still alive but dying. When you consider that their bodies, flesh and blood, was intermingled with the steel of the decks, there's nothing you can do for them.
God.
It's a horrible death.
I wonder how long, it's a gruesome question to ask, but I wonder how long it takes a person. People that are literally chopped in half live for some period of time, so.
Yes.
How long?
It depended on how thoroughly they were buried in the steel. The two on the deck were face down, and the body was virtually full length in the steel. They didn't live more than 2 minutes, if that. Jim, who had his head and shoulders out, lived a little longer. I went over and tried to, he was crying, and went over and tried to comfort him. Duncan took one look at this and everything else, and he headed for the rail. The fields were still around the ship. You still couldn't see the harbor. He jumped overboard. He disappeared. I remained behind, and of course, the fields eventually collapsed. We were back in the harbor.
Well, and did both of you smash everything?
Yes.
But even after being smashed, the fields persisted for some time.
About 2 minutes.
About 2 minutes.
I say 2 minutes. It was approximate. We didn't have a stopwatch to measure it. It might have been longer.
The field was probably radically changing during that 2 minutes.
Yes. So, of course, a boarding party came on board, took a look at this, sent a second boarding party to take the ship back into its berth. And then, of course, we had a four-day-long board of inquiry. I gave my report. They didn't believe me.
They didn't believe you?
No. They didn't believe what I told them about the trip into the future and all of
that.
Oh,
I see. Well, certainly they believed the
Well, they could see the damage to the ship. It was superficial, but nevertheless...
And the men.
Part of the antenna was missing. What happened to the men and the steel was quite obvious. Those otherwise on the deck were insane. Those below deck were all right because they were shielded by the heavy steel walls.
How many lived?
Totally at that time, out of 25, there was about 20 who lived. No, it was less than that. It was about 18.
18.
And eventually, of course... Full quarantine was applied to all of us. Those who were insane went to the funny farms and essentially never came out alive. They died there.
Great memories. Just absolutely great memories. Up next, another special guest as we pay tribute to Art Bell and your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our final segment of our Art Bell tribute. Hard to believe 2 years have already passed since he passed away on that horrible April 13th night. Just absolutely horrible that night. And I had to break the news to all of you, and it was a tough one. It was a tough one. I remember when I first got hired on to do Coast to Coast, and the network said, talk to Art and get some tips. And so I did. I called him up. And he was waiting for the call. He was very instrumental in me being where I am. And he said, don't copy me. Just do your own thing and, you know, do your own bumper music. And I said, yeah, but Art, you've got all the great bumper music. I got to use some of it. And he said, well, don't use all of it. And I'll always remember that. And I inherited a great staff that worked with Art at the time. Our executive producer, Lisa Lyon, and her assistant producer, Stephanie. And they were based out in Oregon, and they still are. But when I came to Los Angeles to start the program, I had another great new staff, Dan Galante, our operations manager, our senior producer, Tom Danheiser, and Lex Lonehood, our webmaster, and Sean Lottasour. They're all still with us, still doing their thing, going on 18 years. And Tom Danheiser's back in the L.A. studio. And first of all, Tom, how are things back there with the lockdown?
Nobody's out on the streets. It's crazy, just like in every city.
Yeah, it is. I just pray that it'll end. But I remember the first time I met you when Craig Kitchen was introducing me to the staff that I would have for Coast to Coast. And you were showing me around, and you had your ideas and things like that. And a couple of the engineers said, no, it's not going to be that way, Dom. And you said, yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
And yes, it is. But you worked with Art, not when he was doing it with Alan Corbeth and that group, but you worked with him when he became our weekend guy.
Yes. That was a lot of fun, actually. Art would do some crazy things. He'd always want to, you know, we play the commercials from here in Los Angeles, but he would always want to play them from where he was.
Yeah, he liked that control.
Yeah, so we'd let him do that. But one of my favorite stories, I'll never forget this, is I'd always know if Art had something, like something to say, or if he just called to kind of, because he wanted to talk for nothing, you know? Because he'd either go, hey, Tom, how's it going? Or he'd go, Tom? And then I'd know, you know, what he meant. So one night I'm home, it's a Saturday night, and I don't work on the weekends, but I prepped his show for him, and the phone rang, and it's like 6 o'clock, and it's Art. He says, Tom? I said, uh-oh. Yeah, Art, how you doing? My cat died. Oh, I'm really, really sorry.
Oh, he was so close to
the
cats.
Yeah, he really loved the cats, and I love animals, so I felt really bad. And he said, Tom, I don't want to go on tonight. I said, okay, Art, I understand. We'll grab a tape. We'll play it. He said, no, 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 no. I want to go on and tell the story, and that's it for 2 or 3 minutes. Well, if you work in radio, you know that you can't just transition from a live voice to a tape. It doesn't sound right. So I tried to tell him that, but he wanted to do what he wanted to do, and it was okay. You know, it was okay. We made it work. And he told the story, but I just never forget that night. I was just in my kitchen, and all of a sudden that call came.
Do you remember the night when we heard that Ramona had passed on?
I do.
And that was another tragic night. And then when Art came back on the air, because he was doing weekends for us, he wanted to keep his hand in there. And, you know, he had retired and came back, retired, came back. Well, this time Ian Punnett was doing the weekends for me. And Art called us up and said, I'm thinking of doing the weekends. What do you think? And we went, hey, that's great if you want to. And he did that for a little bit, but that night he had to go on the air, and he, on his own, he wanted to announce that Ramona had passed on.
Yes.
And that was just a tearjerker.
I think everybody in the whole world was listening. And the one thing I remember about that is the story he told when she'd come home with the groceries. Do you remember?
Yeah.
And she dropped the keys, and I have a key thing like that on my keyring, so every time I look at it, I kind of think of that. You drop it. Don't drop it on the ground. You could hurt it. But that's just the thing I retained from that story. But it was such a great night.
Well, then he went to the Philippines, fell in love, started a new life. I remember he told us that he wanted to stay there indefinitely. So we built a studio for him in his house. He bought a little townhouse out there.
Yes.
And then that lasted about a year. And then he came back to Pahrump and stayed with us for a little bit and then, you know, did his thing on and off.
And the night he died, it was crazy. We just kept trying to verify this. Is this a hoax?
Yeah, I kept saying to you, God, I am not going with that story. I cannot say that he has passed on unless we could verify it. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and finally when you said, read that release, it just like hit you.
Absolutely. Well, let's take some calls here. Let's go to Barry, our dear friend in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hello, Barry.
George, what an incredible show tonight.
Oh, yes.
I'm telling you, buddy, and Art was something else. And, George, I got a couple of questions for you, but let me say I remember the night that he died, and what got me was I was hooked at the time on OxyContin myself. My doctor had given me too much. You remember the story.
I remember. Yep.
And I said that night that I'm getting off of these pills. If Art Bell is going to die from it, I'm not.
Well, thank God you're still with us.
You tell it like it is, George. Yep. But I'm anyway, hello out there, coast to coast land. But two questions about Art's previous interviews. Did they ever find out, George, how deep that hole was up there in Washington? And the second question is, when that guy was flying over Area 51, when the broadcast went dead, did they ever find out if he was dead or not?
No, those two things. First of all, we tried to find Mel Waters and get more information. I wanted to do a Mel's whole follow-up show. And we were never able to find the guy. We can't find him. And I'm not sure anybody's ever found the hole up there.
I tell you what, that guy in that airplane over.
And he disappeared. That Area 51 guy, after that phone call, nobody heard anything about that guy.
I'm telling you, that was a very compelling story. I mean, if that was a hoax, it was well planned.
It was a darn good one indeed. Thanks, Barry. Keep in touch.
Okay, buddy.
I've got open lines Friday, so check in with us. Gary in San Antonio, Texas with us. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Nice of you to do a tribute for Art like that. It really
thank you.
Really nice of you. I remember that night that you told us you choked up.
Oh, it was horrible. Horrible. I mean,
it was genuine emotion. You know, sometimes on the radio you hear people that are kind of faking it, but I could tell you were really, really upset about it. We all were.
Yeah.
And still, when I think about it, I get upset. But anyway, I had two questions for you.
Sure.
One of them is Art Bell's son. Have you ever tried to interview him?
He was interviewed by Bell Gab a few years ago. I have not interviewed him yet. There was an article about him in the Philadelphia Magazine a few years ago. You're talking about the older son?
I thought he only had one son.
No, he's got a smaller one now who's 3 years old. But I'm not gonna interview him.
I'm talking about how old is his older son?
Oh, he's got to be in his 30s or late 30s maybe. Something like that. No, I haven't interviewed him.
Well, it'd be interesting if you did, you know, if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Secondly, is the pyramid, you know, the Giza pyramid. I was talking to some friends when I were watching Ancient Aliens, and you came on the show, and I said, I don't think George has ever been to the Giza pyramids or to Egypt. And they said, oh, I bet he has. You know, he's been everywhere. So I said, well, if I ever get a chance, I'll ask him.
Strangely enough, my father was born in Cairo, but I've never been there.
You ever plan to?
Yeah, and I would love to get out there one day.
I mean, you're almost 70 years old, George.
Yeah, I'm 52.
I guess it's just bad math on my part.
You got
anyway,
it.
Have a good evening. Thanks
okay, my friend. Thanks for being on the program. Next up, let's go to Alamogordo, New Mexico. Al's with us. Welcome to the program, Al. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. George, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I remember listening to Art Bell when his wife passed. And if you remember, he had a psychic call up.
Yeah.
And only him and his wife knew the secret. And the psychic contacted him. and he put her on the air, and that was an amazing story that, that I remember. And also Evelyn Paglini, I had
the Good Witch.
Yes.
You know, she predicted this coronavirus. I played a little clip of her a couple weeks ago that we did back, I think, around 2009. And she said that there's going to be a pandemic virus unleashed on the people. Strange.
I missed that when you played that. I wish I would have heard that.
I might do that. I might play it again next week.
But, George, a quick shout-out to you, too. I met you probably about 8-9 years ago, San Fernando Valley. You were at Universal City. You had a little show there.
Yes.
And I want to tell people you're an even nicer in person than you are on the air. You're just an amazing person. And a quick shout-out, you said a nice thing to the traffic officers of the city of L.A., which I was for 30 years.
Oh, good for you.
I'll never forget the kind words you said about us, sir. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Al. Appreciate it. Let's go next to Cornelius in Alexandria, Louisiana. Hello, Corny.
Hey, George, boy, I tell you, that Barry, he's a character. But I want to tell you a little quick story about Art Bell.
I got a minute and a half for you. Go for it.
Right. Okay. Well, Art, I had predicted the Saints would win the Super Bowl and everything, and then 10 years from there, it'd be the end of America. Now, that was my prediction. And, of course, the Saints won the Super Bowl. So we're in 2020 now. But a little thing Art told me, one time I gave him a last name. And so I was on the wild card line. I'm going to call you Wild Card White. That's going to be my nickname for you. So that's my little thing from Art Bell. God bless you, George and Tommy. We love you out here.
All right, my friend. Don't forget open lines coming up on Friday. And we'll have a great time there. Yeah, a little bit of information on Art. And we're going to wrap things up with a song I wrote when he passed away years ago. And, of course, the song I wrote, if I remember correctly, was when he retired. And we had a production manager by the name of Rob the Iceman Eisenberg. And I said, Robbie, here, I'm going to write this song to Thanks for the Memories. And I need you to sing it and record it. I'm not going to do it. I want you to. And he grabbed it, put it together, and he did just a great job. But we've got a great group of programs for you for the rest of the week. Thank you to all of you who have supported this program since Art's inception. And while I've been carrying the torch, we really appreciate it. And many, many more years to come, thank God. Now, listen in to this little tribute for our friend Art Bell.
Thanks for the memories of things we can't forget. An alien in a net. The wondrous shows around the clock that never seem to stop. How lucky we were. Hey, Art Bell, I want to tell you, thanks for the memories. The time you glued your lips, we almost did a flip. The UFOs and Bigfoot shows we never ever skipped. How lucky we were. Now since you're gone, we wake up to weekends you used to shake up. We long for the sound of your laughter and the pictures of cats that purr. And thanks for the memories of every show a thrill. It's better than a pill. We've lived a lot and learned a lot. We loved you so and still we miss you so much. Hey, I didn't write this. George Norrie did. Ain't that something? Thanks for the memories of how we used to think, even with a drink. That night you took us on a ride, it almost turned us pink. We miss you so much. Thanks for the memories of JC screaming hate, the time he lost his mate, the search for Mel's hole deep within our soul. How lucky we were. Gone are your evenings in the desert, but the show you created will go on. So we remember forever and wish that you were talking on. And thanks for the memories of radios we bought, Sea Crane's website that we sought, campfire nights, the spooky frights, the theories that you taught. How lucky we were. And thanks for the memories. They say grown men never cry. Well, Art, that's just a lie. So we say goodbye, my friend, with a gasp and sigh. And thank you so much. Hey, this is Bob calling from the great beyond, Hope, saying so long, Art Bell. Ain't that something?
How about that, folks? For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.